From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we pay tribute to Broadway in celebration of its 100th anniversary this year. We'll hear from the creators of some of Broadway's greatest musicals. It's part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives. We'll feature interviews with composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the books for West Side Story and Gypsy, Cy Feuer, who produced the original Guys and Dolls, and the late choreographer and director Michael Bennett, creator of A Chorus Line. This year is also the 50th anniversary of the collaboration of Rodgers and Hammerstein. The original cast recording of their musical South Pacific has just been reissued. Critic Lloyd Schwartz will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. With Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry still undecided, the Senate neared passage of President Clinton's economic package. Kerry met for 90 minutes with the president at the White House, but says he has yet to make a final determination. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
As Republican and Democratic senators continued to debate the package of tax increases and spending cuts, the White House kept the pressure on Senator Kerry. Kerry initially voted in support of the package, but now he says it isn't meaningful deficit reduction. Republicans agree. South Dakota Republican Larry Pressler and others spent the day pointing out that 80% of the spending cuts don't occur until after the next presidential election. The administration's response is that same formulas used by Republicans in their alternative package. Many of the same arguments were heard on the House floor last night, leading up to a two-vote victory. The vote is expected to be even closer in the Senate, where 49 Democrats say they support the package. Kerry is still unsure, and Vice President Al Gore is standing by to break a tie the White House is now counting on. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Federal Elections Commission has imposed a record $100,000 in civil penalties against the 1988 presidential campaign of Senator Robert Dole. The FEC charged the campaign with a number of violations, including exceeding state spending limits and accepting too much money from Dole's Political Action Committee and from individuals. Another $23,000 in fines were levied against the Dole PAC, other contractors, and individuals. Dole, the Senate Republican leader, complained today that the FEC has already changed many of the rules under which his PAC was fined. The National Weather Service says the Mississippi River is cresting today in St. Genevieve, Missouri, but work crews say their battle with high water won't be over until the river is back to flood stage. Dave Cohen of member station KBIA has more.
The levee in St. Genevieve is now built to hold back a river stage of at least 50 feet. The Weather Service says the Mississippi is cresting just a yard below that. The water isn't rising, but the levee continues to leak, and the Army Corps of Engineers, Ken Kruchowski, says they won't relax until the water drops another 8 feet. He says the levee is not a traditional design.
The levee's made out of sandbags, out of earth, out of rock, out of about anything they've been able to pile up. The water has been right up near the top of it now for about 2 weeks, and we're just hoping that it will hold until this water comes down off that levee.
Kruchowski says leaks keep popping up and workers keep piling rock on them. Water could breach the levee as long as the river is out of its banks, and that will be until October. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Cohen reporting.
Stock prices moved higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 3,560. This is NPR News. At least 4 people were killed today and about 150 were injured when a tornado ripped through the town of Petersburg, Virginia. Witnesses said the storm split open a shopping mall, collapsing part of a Walmart store where 4 people died. Others were injured when the storm tore through the town's historic district, damaging several buildings that survived a Union bombardment during the Civil War. After talks with Syrian leaders in Damascus, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said he was leaving the area more encouraged than expected, but he said no date has been set for the next round of peace talks in Washington. Meanwhile, Israeli officials say 3 of their soldiers were killed in 2 incidents in the occupied West Bank. John Devitt has more from Jerusalem.
In the latest incident, 3 Palestinian gunmen opened fire on an Israeli army outpost near Tulkarem in the occupied West Bank. 2 Israeli soldiers were killed in the initial burst of gunfire from the Palestinians' car. Earlier, another Israeli soldier who was returning home from his base in the occupied territories was seized as he took a lift in a van. Despite a widespread search, the van wasn't found for 3 hours when it was discovered on fire near the town of Ramallah. The soldier's charred body was found inside. The violence came as the U.S. Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, left Israel, repeating that he was full of hope and enthusiasm that progress could be made in the Middle East peace talks. Again, there was no concrete evidence to support the Secretary of State's optimism. Instead, the reminders of the violence that lies just beneath the surface in this region.
John Devitt reporting for the BBC. Secretary Christopher toured the Aviano Air Base today in Italy, where NATO has assembled a force of warplanes that could be used to attack positions in Bosnia. Christopher threatened that the NATO planes could be used in strikes against the Bosnian Serbs unless they lift the siege of Sarajevo. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Broadway is celebrating its 100th birthday this year. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from a few of the people who've created some of Broadway's greatest musicals. It's part of our weekly program of interviews from our archives. We start with one of Broadway's greatest lyricists and composers, Stephen Sondheim. His mentor was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Sondheim is the composer and lyricist who's done the most to update the Rodgers and Hammerstein tradition. His musicals include Anyone Can Whistle, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, and Into the Woods. He broke into Broadway writing lyrics for two now classic musicals, West Side Story and Gypsy. Here's the Jet Song from the original cast recording of West Side Story, music by Leonard Bernstein.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you... Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out. Let's get cracking.
Where are you gonna find Bernardo?
At the dance tonight at the gym.
But the gym's neutral territory.
Ooh, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-O.
So everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony and me at 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're jets.
The greatest.
When you're a jet, you're the top cat in town. You're the gold medal kid with the heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swinginest thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king. The jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clicking. The sharks are steer clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken. Here come the jets like a bat out of hell. Someone gets in our way. Someone don't feel so well. Here come the jets, little world, step aside. Better go underground, better run, better hide. We're drawing the line, so keep your noses hidden. We're hanging a sign, says visitors forbidden, and we ain't kidding. Here come the jets, yeah, and we're gonna be every last bargain gang on the whole bargain street, on the whole.
I spoke to Stephen Sondheim in 1988, and he told me he was still embarrassed by some of his lyrics for West Side Story.
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic, and his idea of poetic and mine are different. And I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young. And so I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics.
That was the next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, well, no, this, no, actually, no. I think. First of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. No, in fact, I'd never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three. But once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose. When I write lyrics, I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric, a whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note, like he wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. When you're, who stole my heart away? Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
No, I have. When I think that the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character. I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes. Not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it. When I think that it's either out of character, or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed, and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time, not lag behind them, nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air, and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of a... I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But anyway, there are fewer words, and therefore each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next. They don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat. And that's what working out a puzzle is.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1988. Coming up from our archives, an interview with Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the books for Sondheim's first two musicals, West Side Story and Gypsy. Here's Ethel Merman from the original cast recording of Gypsy, singing one of Sondheim's great lyrics, music by Julie Stein.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. that's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom, living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people of 105. But that I gotta see yet, all the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be yet. Come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's peachy for some people, for some humdrum people to be.
Arthur Lawrence not only wrote the book for Gypsy, he directed the recent Broadway revival, which starred Tyne Daly. He also directed La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It For You Wholesale, and Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle. Gypsy was based on the memoirs of stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. I spoke to Arthur Lawrence in January of 1990, early into the run of his revival of Gypsy, and he told me why he wanted to revive it.
Because I was asked to, and I loved the show, and it seemed I felt that enough time had passed that the show could finally be done the way I thought it should be done. When it originally played in New York, it was considered a very tough, unpleasant show, and the production was really rather sweet. It laid off a lot of things that, it being 1989, I was able to do. It's very different from the other productions. It goes much more deeply into the relationships, into what I would call the dark side of it.
What's an example of something that was too unpleasant for the original production that you could go into now?
Well, it still is. I mean, Mother is still sacrosanct in America, and a lot of people don't like seeing this woman, who is not the most pleasant mother in the world. But also there is the relationship between Rose and Herbie the agent is extremely sexual now. It has elements of romance, but it's distinctly a man-woman relationship. That was never played before.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the original production, Ethel Merman starred as Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from what I've read about the original production, you weren't really satisfied with her performance.
You didn't read that anyplace.
Well, what I read was that you referred to her as an opening night performer, someone who gave her all on opening night.
Yes, she gave her all, but
That after that, it kind of diminished a little bit.
That's true. I'm very grateful to Merman because I don't think they would have done the show without her,
mm-hmm.
even though she was on the skids, as it were, at that time. She had had a flop or two, and as a matter of fact, the show opened with almost no advance. And if we hadn't gotten good reviews, David Merrick, the producer, told me we'd play 6 weeks and that was it. She did us a great service. And for that time, she was terrific. But it was never what I felt the performance should be.
Well, I read that one night you had a talk with her in front of the whole cast about her performance, about her not giving her all. What did you say to her?
I don't know where you read that.
I think it was in Sondheim and Company.
Well, it's only semi-true.
Mm-hmm.
What it was, I don't think she wasn't really an actress. She didn't know she had taken to walking through the show. But what I called her on was that she and Jack Klugman, who was played opposite her, the show had been running 6 months, and they were breaking up on stage, telling each other jokes, which I think is insulting to an audience. The audience comes, make them laugh, not each other. And I called her on that.
What was her reaction?
Oh, it was as though she were a naughty little child who'd been spanked. She took it.
Mm-hmm.
And went right on doing it again.
When you're writing the book for a musical, do you have a sense in your mind of where the songs belong and what the transition into the song is going to be like?
Total. That's the way I write. I plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
I do as much as possible to write into the music. Let the music take over. lift the characters to the point where they can't do anything else but sing.
Can you give us an example?
Yes. At the end of the first act of Gypsy, there's a song called Everything's Coming Up Roses, which if you haven't seen the show, you think is a kind of happy, jazzy Broadway tune. What happens with that song is one of the reasons why I don't want it, and we all don't want it to be made into a movie again. What is done with that song you can only do on the stage. You can't do it in the movies because movies are too literal. What happens is a woman literally goes off her rocker and bursts into that song. This is a woman who suddenly has an enormous disappointment. She's furious. She's angry. She rages. And she rages until she can't anymore, and it comes out musically. It's against the emotion. It's all this ridiculous, insane optimism that this woman has. And it's done in music.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we listen to Everything's Coming Up Roses? Angela Lansbury singing. This is from the London production that you directed in 1973.
And just remember that listening to her
mm-hmm.
are her daughter and her lover, and they are terrified and stunned by this woman's madness.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now, honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks, clear the tracks, you've got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow, honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning.
That's Angela Lansbury from the 1973 production of Gypsy, which was directed by my guest, Arthur Lawrence. Arthur Lawrence also wrote the book for Gypsy, and he also wrote the book for West Side Story and the screenplays for The Way We Were, The Turning Point, and Rope. His directing credits include La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It for You Wholesale, and Anyone Can Whistle. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Arthur Lawrence is my guest. Do you ever feel that the librettist gets the least credit in a musical? You know, in a musical, you always hear so much more sometimes about the songwriters.
Every librettist feels that, and it's accurate. No musical is ever referred to as the work of the librettist. It is only referred to in terms of the composer and, if the lyricist is as famous as Steve Sondheim, the lyricist. I think that goes back to opera, where you don't know who wrote the libretto for the operas. Mm-hmm. You only know the composer. And I think one of the reasons we don't have more and better playwrights writing musicals is that everybody has a need for recognition, which is, by the way, what Gypsy is really about. And it is so frustrating not to get any recognition for what one has done in creating a musical that a lot of playwrights simply won't try. And you get the people write letters to the Times and the critics say, oh, yes. And then for 2 minutes they recognize the librettist and then they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply a given. The reason I do it is I just love musical theater. And I love writing them. I'm stuck.
Let me ask you about the book that you wrote for West Side Story. Now, I believe the idea for a musical based on Romeo and Juliet was the choreographer Jerome Robbins.
That's right.
Well, how did he originally pitch it to you? What was the initial idea he proposed?
The initial idea was quite different from what it was. It was about a Jewish girl and a Catholic boy in New York over Easter and Passover. And I thought that was AB's Irish Rose, and I wanted no part of it. And then several years passed, and I happened to be in California, and Lenny Bernstein was in California. By that time, juvenile delinquent gangs had come into being. And on the coast, there was a great problem with Chicanos, which in New York was Puerto Ricans. That's where the idea came from, the front page. And that's what the... And then Lenny and I called Jerry and said, we're ready to go.
Did you have any reservations about singing and dancing gangs?
On the stage, no. In the movie, yes.
Mm-hmm.
On the stage, the stage is total illusion. You come into a box, and you see this proscenium, and then people hop on and hop off. There's an orchestra in the pit. But people have imagination, and the theater makes you use it. And you will accept almost anything. But movies, to me, are either... The nature of the medium is such that movies are either realistic, by that I mean naturalistic, or surrealistic. To me, in the movie A West Side Story, I know it was a great hit, but when those boys came tour-jeteing down the street, I didn't believe it for a minute. I still don't.
Now, you didn't write the screenplay for either Gypsy or West Side Story. Did you want to?
I wasn't asked to write the screenplay for West Side Story, and I wanted to. I was asked to write the screenplay for Gypsy, and I was going to till they told me they cast Rosalind Russell, and the director was Mervyn LeRoy, and I bowed out. We had wanted Judy Garland. They didn't because they said she had a weight problem. But of course, with the passage of time, Gypsy covers 15 years, even if she had a weight problem. If the white weight went up and down, it wouldn't have mattered.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the movie?
Of Gypsy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a candidate for one of the worst movies I ever saw.
So, you know,
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The only good thing in the movie was Natalie Wood.
Uh-huh.
R.I.P.
Well, just give me a sense of what you hate about the film.
Well, Rosalind Russell was very busy being Rosalind Russell. Again, she was wonderful in Wonderful Town. She's wonderful when she played this, what they used to call a dame. This hard-driving, executive, smart-cracking, certainly middle-class, if not upper-middle-class, woman. This is nothing from this blousy, vulgar, common, trashy Rose. I mean, she wore chic clothes. I remember her black and white high heels in the train station. It was just all off.
Now, you're the director. Do you go night after night to the theater?
I certainly do not. I'm working on a new show, happily, gladly.
When is it time for you to stop going?
Never. I go back every certain number of weeks to check up on them and, as in the immortal words of George Kaufman, remove the improvements.
Arthur Lawrence wrote the books for Gypsy and West Side Story and directed the recent revival of Gypsy. Our interview was recorded in 1990. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More Broadway interviews from our archives in the second part of our show.
What's your act like, Tulsa?
Sit over there, Louise. Well, you see, I pretend I'm home getting dressed for a date. I take a comb my hair, take a flower, smell it, put it in my lapel. Then I spot the audience. Once my clothes were shabby, tailors called me cabby. So I took a vow, said this bumblebee, Bo Brummel. Now I'm smooth and snappy, now my tailor's happy. I'm the cat's meow, my wardrobe is wow. Paris silk, Harris tweed.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more Broadway stories from our archives. We'll feature an interview with the late choreographer and director Michael Bennett, who created a chorus line. Also, the story of how Guys and Dolls was created, as told by Cy Feuer, one of the producers of the original Broadway production. The original cast recording of South Pacific has been reissued. Lloyd Schwartz will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In advance of this evening's vote in the House on the president's deficit-cutting proposal, Mr. Clinton met today at the White House with Nebraska Democrat Bob Kerry. Kerry is the senator whose vote tonight could determine whether the bill is approved by the Senate. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
Kerry, who lost the Democratic presidential nomination to Clinton last year, voted yes on the deficit reduction plan in May. But since then, he's been complaining that the revised version doesn't include enough spending cuts. Since the president has only 50 yes votes counted, Kerry's support is crucial if the White House is to get the bare 51-vote majority it needs to win. Over the past several days, the president has been trying to send a number of signals that Kerry's concerns would be met. The senator has asked for a special session of Congress to be convened in the fall to search for more ways to cut spending. The president says he's open to that idea, and he's promised he would take additional steps to curb spending. It's not known what other agreements the president may have made with Senator Kerry this morning, but White House officials say they're confident Senator Kerry will vote yes. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A tornado hit parts of Petersburg, Virginia this afternoon, killing at least four people and injuring more than 100 others. The storm ripped through the city's Old Town area and cut through a Walmart store in Colonial Heights. One witness said that he was driving into the parking lot when everything started collapsing. 149 people were taken to local hospitals. The National Weather Service said it's not clear now if more than one tornado hit the area. The defense in the bank fraud trial of Washington attorney Robert Altman ended 2.5 days of closing arguments today. Altman's attorneys told the New York State Supreme Court jury that prosecutors had presented pieces of evidence but had failed to prove their case. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Altman is accused of allowing the Bank of Credit and Commerce International to acquire control of Washington-based First American Bank while he served as an executive there. Prosecutors say he later lied to federal regulators about the relationship between the banks. Today, Altman's attorney, Gus Newman, told the jury it must not be swayed by Altman's association with the notorious BCCI, but must weigh the charges against him on their own merits. And he said prosecutors had failed to prove that BCCI secretly controlled First American, or that Altman concealed any information about the relationship from federal banking regulators. He said regulators never maintained otherwise until the BCCI scandal broke and they needed a political scapegoat. The prosecution is to present its final arguments on Monday. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 11 points to close at 3,560.43 on volume of 221 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House has given final approval to President Clinton's National Service Plan. The measure needs to be approved in the Senate one more time before going on to the White House for the president's signature. By a vote of 275 to 152, the House approved the three-year, $1.5 billion bill 2 days after it came out of conference, where differences between a House and Senate measure were worked out. Under the plan, college students are able to earn tuition money by work in public service jobs. Opposition to the plan was mainly on the Republican side, where opponents argue the nation cannot afford to pay for the bill. A federal judge in New York laid down some ground rules today for the September trial of four alleged suspects in the bombing of the World Trade Center earlier this year. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
Federal Judge Kevin Duffy announced that the trial, set to begin on September 14th, would have an anonymous jury, but one that would not be sequestered. The judge said he had already begun to send out requests for jurors and said it may be the largest ever request for jurors he has ever made in the history of the district. The judge said he had considered a change of venue for the trial and had thought about relocating to Cincinnati. But most of the defense lawyers said they believed a fair and impartial trial could most likely be found in a population as diverse as New York City's. The judge did say he thought it would be close to impossible to find jurors who have never heard of the case of the World Trade Center bombing, which occurred in February and left 6 people dead. The judge also said he was considering canceling opening statements. The trial is expected to last several months. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
Officials in Bonn say unemployment in Western Germany is now at its highest point ever. There are now more than 2 million people looking for jobs in Western Germany, an increase of 27% compared to a year ago at the same time. Unemployment in July rose to 7.5% of the workforce in Western Germany, up from 7%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This year, Broadway is celebrating its 100th birthday, so today on our weekly archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with some of the people who've created great Broadway musicals.
When you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some gold. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane. There's only a John with me for a chain. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could match the Cosmo Hall, call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money. That guy's only doing it for some gold.
We're listening to the cast recording of the current Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. We're going to find out how Guys and Dolls first became a musical from one of the men who created it, Cy Feuer. He was one of the producers of the original 1950 production. Feuer and his partner Ernest Martin came up with the idea of a musical based on a Damon Runyon story. And they hired composer Frank Lesser, who gave us one of Broadway's best scores. Together, Feuer and Martin also produced two Cole Porter musicals, Can Can and Silk Stockings, as well as The Boyfriend, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Little Me. More recently, they produced the film adaptations of A Chorus Line and Cabaret. Feuer's story of Guys and Dolls begins with one of those proverbial phone calls.
My partner called me from California. There was and he had just finished reading a book called Guys and Dolls. There's no story called Guys and Dolls. This was a collection of Runyon stories. And he called me and he said he thought it was that the idea of doing a Runyon musical, what did I think of it? And we were both Runyon fans, and I responded to it. And also, he thought that Guys and Dolls was a terrific title.
How did you decide on Frank Lesser to write the score? A great choice, obviously.
Well, Frank did our first show before the Guys and Dolls. And also, Frank and I go way back together. I was a musical director and knew Frank. As a matter of fact, I put Frank and Julie Stein together on a picture out at Republic. So we were all old friends. And Frank, at that time, was principally a lyricist. He did not write the music. He had done a few things in the Army during the war. But he was really a lyricist, working with some very well-known composers. And we used him on our first show.
That was Where's Charlie?
And Where's Charlie, yes. Hal Arlen was supposed to do the music and Frank the lyrics for Where's Charlie. And we were all living in California at the time. And at that time, Harold's house burned down. And his wife was very upset. She was having some problems anyway. And his burned down with all the memorabilia and everything that they owned. And he came to us and said, look, fellas, I can't go to New York. I've got too much. This is too upsetting. The family is just in disarray, and I just can't go. And Frank said, upon hearing this, said to me, listen, why don't you let me do the whole thing? And we decided to do that, and he did.
So that's how Frank Lesser actually started writing music?
Well, he wrote music before that. He wrote Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition in the Army.
Oh, wow. And I didn't realize that was his.
Yeah, and he wrote a Western song that was kind of popular. A few things before Where's Charlie? He was just getting into it at the time, you know.
So what was the first song Frank Lesser showed you for Guys and Dolls?
Oh, the first thing he did, I think this was the first, because we never knew where to put it. He wrote it without, in just in general tone of Runyon, was the Fugue for Tin Horns.
I've Got a Horse Right Here. His name is Paul Revere. That
right.
One.
Yeah. Because that had the general tone of Runyon. And oddly enough, we had the whole show assembled. We didn't know where to put it. It didn't fit in anything. It had nothing to do with the plot. it was about horse playing, and ours was about crap shooting, you know what I mean? And we never dealt with horse players.
Yeah.
This was a generic gambler thing, you know what I mean, which he wrote. And it was sensational, and it was dangling there. And Ernie came up with the idea, and he said, listen, if we don't know where to put it, let's open with it, because it doesn't have to do with anything. We haven't established any characters yet, so let them just open with it. And we did. We put it into the opening, establishing just the gambling attitude of three of our characters, having nothing to do with the main plot.
It's a great song. Why don't I play some of it?
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do, can do. I can't him down a tight, got the morning line, the guy has got a figure at 5 to 9, but
that's the fugue for tin horns from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls. My guest was the original producer of Guys and Dolls, Cy Feuer. Now, I think you cut one of the numbers right before opening night?
Yeah, you got a lot of this information. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was a number called Traveling Light. It was a number in 5-4, actually, written by Frank, which is an unusual meter to write a song in. And it was done by Sam Levine and Bob Alder. And Sam was terrible. He just couldn't sing at all. He was kind of tone deaf. And we had them doing this number, and we struggled through it all throughout the out of town, and it was just awful. And finally, I said to everybody, listen, I've had enough of this. We're going to get rid of it. And Sam was a difficult man, you know, very tough. So it was before the first preview in New York at the 46th Street Theater. And I called the company on the stage. And I said, I want you all to take note of this because there's a cut and you all have to pay attention because it'll affect all of the cues and your entrances and everything. Be prepared because it's a 3-minute cut in this particular scene. And I want the stage managers to note this. Let your wardrobe people know about it in case it affects the change and so forth. And I made this long speech never getting to what the cut was, you know. And finally, I had a door. There was a door on the side of the auditorium. It led right on onto 46th Street, you see, where I had a cab waiting, you see. And I said, we're cutting Traveling Light. I saw Sam go white, and I went out the door and jumped into the cab and left.
You were afraid they were going to be so angry that you'd better get the heck out of there?
Just Sam, yeah. And there was nobody that he could yell at because there was nobody around to reverse the decision, you know.
So did they follow your orders after you fled?
Yeah. Well, I told the stage manager and everything beforehand. This was what it was going to be, and we cut it.
Was it a good song?
Wonderful. I had Traveling Light. Yes, I'm Traveling Light. Got my ticket in my pocket, and I'm ready to blow town. It's in a 5-4 tempo. Very odd.
Uh-huh. Gee, I wonder if anybody's recorded it.
No, it's never been recorded.
Huh. I'd like to hear that sometime. What are your memories of opening night of Guys and Dolls?
Terrific. When the trumpet played First Call, you know, we'd done that whole opening and everything, and then the three guys went to the newsstand and picked up the scratch sheets, and the trumpet played da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was a big laugh. And I turned to my wife and I said, we're home. This is it. They're ready.
Cy Feuer produced the original Guys and Dolls. Coming up from the archives, an interview with the late choreographer and director, Michael Bennett. This is Fresh Air. Broadway lost one of its great talents in 1987 when Michael Bennett died. He was 44 and had AIDS. Bennett is best remembered as the creator of the hit musical A Chorus Line, which became the longest-running show in Broadway history. But long before that show made him famous, Bennett was a much sought-after choreographer. His credits include Company and Follies. Shortly before his death, his 1981 hit Dreamgirls was revived on Broadway. I spoke with Michael Bennett in 1985 when he was in Philadelphia with the touring company of Dreamgirls. Bennett told me that as a young boy growing up in Buffalo, he knew he would someday work on Broadway.
I used to come every summer when I was from 11 on, and I would go see all the Broadway shows, and I knew I wanted to be just like Jerry Robbins. He was my idol then. And that, I was very unhappy that I wasn't born in New York. It was like a tragedy. I wanted to be born right on 44th Street in Schubert Alley. I think that would have been perfect for me.
I know that Jerome Robbins has been a great influence on you, and you really admired his choreography.
Mm-hmm. I have only worked with him for 2 hours, my whole
2 life.
2 hours?
Is that all?
Yes.
I mean,
when
I
played Baby John in West Side Story when I was beginning my career, we were going to Europe for a year. And he came in because one of his dance captains had staged the company and everything. And he came in for 2 hours and rehearsed for 2 hours. He gave me one note on one step. Make my arms straighter.
And did that stay with you for the rest of your life?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have done many, many steps where my arms are not always straight, But for that step, they were straight every single performance I did.
I always think that auditions for you must be really hard now because you've written the musical about how people, how their personality and identity isn't always revealed during that first audition, and they have so much on the line. And they really are individuals. They're not just faceless chorus line dancers. And there you are judging thousands of people.
Well, chorus line goes a little deeper than I normally do at auditions. But it is very important to talk to people in an audition. But also it's about chemistry of a cast. I mean, there are people who are neurotic and talented, and there are people, and it's worth putting up with the neurosis, but there are people that are destructively neurotic in terms of a whole company. And you must get a chemistry of a company not only to be able to do the show and do it brilliantly 8 times a week, but to be able to get along.
How can you tell in the short time that you have in those initial auditions if someone's going to be destructively neurotic?
I always audition people 3 times before I hire them.
What do you ask for in a typical audition?
Well, if I'm starting with dancers, I ask for a double pirouette and a time step, and you can tell if people have had any training, and that's all you need to see. And that first, and I eliminate down. Then I actually teach combinations and dance styles and find out. Then you know exactly how much training they've had, and then you ask them about it. Then you talk to them. Then they sing. Then they read. And there's three. I never hire anyone I don't see 3 times, because somebody can be wonderful in the first audition. And then something happens in the second. Or they're great 3 auditions and you're just, you're thrilled and you write the part and you make it bigger.
Have you ever made any big mistakes with casting?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Can you fire them?
You have to. I mean, it's for the good of the whole show. You can't let a show go down for one person. You just can't. It's very hard to do. But you have to.
Steel yourself beforehand. Do you do it yourself? Do you do the firing yourself?
I always do it myself.
It sounds like that's important to you, to do it yourself.
Well, it's my mistake. It's not their mistake. If I miscast them, it's my mistake. And okay. I owe them an apology.
How did you become involved in Dreamgirls?
In Dreamgirls, Tom Ion and Henry Krieger, who were the writers, brought the idea to me.
How did they pitch it to you? What did they tell you?
They brought 16 songs and an outline for a story, and I put them into workshop. You see, I have a process which is called the workshop process, which is the way I did Chorus Line. And it's 4 6-week rehearsal periods, and you try out parts of the show. And you fix a show and shape a show around the performers, and without the pressure of being in a hotel room in Boston and a deadline and being in previews. And when you're satisfied with what's in the room, then you raise the $6 million and you go out and you do the musical.
Everyone describes Dreamgirls as being patterned on the story of the Supremes. How literally is it really patterned on them?
Well, the Supremes were, of course, the most successful of the girl groups. There were many, many girl groups. There were many cast changes in those girl groups. I knew the Supremes very well because I was a dancer on Hullabaloo, an assistant choreographer, and they used to do the show every 2 weeks. But it is not the story of the Supremes. Now, if it were the story of the Supremes, believe me, I would have been sued.
What's the difference on Broadway between what the director does and what the choreographer does?
The work should be seamless. The truth is you should never know who did what. But I think director-choreographers are more successful with what has happened to the musical. because the musical numbers, I mean, in the old days, you know, Agnes de Mille, there would be a ballet, and that was a big innovation. The ballet had something to do with the show. Because before that, there used to be this play, and then the dancing girls would come out in the middle while they changed sets behind a drop. I mean, now it's all integrated. The dancing tells, a dance number should tell as much about the plot as the next scene, like the next song does.
The late Broadway director and choreographer Michael Bennett. I spoke with him in 1985. He died of complications from AIDS in 1987. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
The budget, Terry, the budget. The House barely passed it last night, and the Senate has been debating it all day. We'll be following that fight and taking a look at Senator Bob Kerry, who apparently is the man in the middle, the man on the fence. We'll talk to a member of the House who switched her vote at the last minute to make it possible for the plan to pass. Closing arguments in New York today in the BCCI case. Jim Zeroli will have a report. We're going back to Benning Road, the community here in Washington that we've been looking at. And we will listen to one of the themes of Dvorak that comes from the Scarlet Tanager.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Composer Richard Rodgers and lyricist Oscar Hammerstein started their collaboration 50 years ago. To commemorate the anniversary, the original cast recording of their musical South Pacific has been reissued. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger, you may see a stranger. Across a crowded room, and somehow you know even then, that somewhere you see her again and again. Some enchanted evening.
That may be the best loved song from a musical comedy ever written for an opera singer. The show, of course, was Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, and the singer is the great Italian basso Ezio Pinza. Some Enchanted Evening made Pinza a Broadway matinee idol. It's one of the great romantic songs. Richard Rodgers' arching melody lends a passionate authenticity to what are really some pretty corny lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein. Rodgers and Hammerstein brilliantly played off Pinza's operatic grandeur against Mary Martin's endearing, infinitely nuanced American naivete. At the heart of Hammerstein's script, with its heavy moral about racial tolerance, is the old musical comedy theme of the meeting and eventual merging of European and American traditions. While Pinza sings about enchanted evenings, the Mary Martin character, Nellie Forbush, sings in self-consciously American cliches. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm only a cockeyed optimist. Or I'm in love with a wonderful guy. That song seems to be almost as much about the use of language as about love.
As corny as Kansas in August, I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in the conventional dither with the conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as trite and as gay as a daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night, pouring light on the dew. I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July. If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love with a wonderful guy.
In 1955, 16 years after South Pacific, Rodgers and Hammerstein tapped another great opera singer, the American Wagnerian soprano Helen Traubel. The show, Pipe Dream, was based on John Steinbeck's Sweet Thursday, a story about a California brothel. Neither Rodgers nor Hammerstein felt quite at home in that setting, and the show flopped. The score, however, supplied pop stars like Perry Como and Eddie Fisher with such big hits as All at Once You Love Her and Everybody's Got a Home But Me, a song about homelessness with one of Rodgers' prettiest tunes. But it was the inspired casting of Traubel as a madam that created the show's real energy. Traubel's sense of humor was as boundless as her voice. On the original cast album, you can hear what a good sport she was.
Some shirts hanging up on a clothesline kept waving their tails my way. Hiya, fauna, hiya, babe. Ain't this a doll of a day? Hi, kids. Ain't this a doll of a day? What a day it's been for dreaming. My dreams have...
For the 50th anniversary of Rodgers and Hammerstein's collaboration, RCA has reissued the rarest of their show albums, Pipe Dream, Me and Juliet, and the experimental Allegro. Not their best scores, but each has at least one great tune. Sony's new South Pacific CD has three juicy bonus tracks, Mary Martin singing two songs cut from the original show, and Pins's single of Bally High, a song he didn't sing on stage. I wish some video company would put out the marvelous scenes Pinza and Martin did together on the old Ed Sullivan show. Sony has also reissued the remarkable complete recording on two CDs of another show with an opera singer, a show that was more operatic in its basic conception, Frank Lesser's The Most Happy Fella, which starred the distinguished Met baritone Robert Weedy. All these shows made it possible for wonderful singers to continue their careers after they were past their operatic primes. They, in turn, added a new range to the American musical and gave the American ideal of a cultural melting pot an interesting Broadway twist.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific. It's been reissued on CD by Sony Broadway. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Dites-moi, pourquoi la vie est belle? Dites-moi, pourquoi
la vie est gaie?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Imagine going blind and then 15 years later, seeing again. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with historian Robert Hine. He lost his sight at the age of 50, and 15 years later regained vision in one eye through surgery. Also, we talk with George Kuchar about his underground films of the 60s and his new video journals. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.